Welcome to Lymphoma and Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jeremy Abramson from Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And to begin, he commented on perhaps the most exciting new area of research development in oncology, including lymphomas and CLL, the use of immunotherapy.
It's been a very exciting time for new drugs in lymphoma across multiple different modalities. I think one of the exciting areas, as with all of oncology, has been with immunotherapy. And there are generally two separate classes of those agents. One are the immune checkpoint inhibitors that are, of course, all the rage in solid tumor oncology. But immune checkpoint inhibitors have great rationale in a number of different lymphoma subtypes. And one thing that we know about Hodgkin lymphoma is that virtually all cases of Hodgkin lymphoma have amplifications of 9p24, which includes the PD-L1 and PD-L2 loci, making it a rational target. And that PD-L1 and PD-L2 can be stained for immunohistochemically in virtually all Reed Sternberg cells in Hodgkin lymphoma. And so two different PD-1 inhibitors, nivolumab and pembrolizumab, have both been evaluated in multiply relapsed and refractory Hodgkin lymphoma and found to have very encouraging response rates, with about two-thirds of patients responding in both of those studies with either of those agents, many of those responses being quite durable. So the immune checkpoint inhibitors have been most exciting in Hodgkin lymphoma. There have been some subsets of non-Hodgkin lymphoma where they have been similarly encouraging. But obviously, the non-Hodgkin lymphoma is a very heterogeneous field, and so they're really quite distinct biologically as entities. Among those that have been quite interesting is primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma. This is a high-grade B-cell lymphoma, a subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but one that has biological overlaps with classical Hodgkin lymphoma, including a high incidence of those 9p24 amplifications. And so it creates sound biologic rationale. And sure enough, in a small phase 2 study that was recently reported, there's a very high response rate in that specific subset of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, while the response rate in DLBCL as a whole is overall quite low. Other areas in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that have responded nicely are those that are associated with the Epstein-Barr virus. So as of today, the non-Hodgkin lymphomas that have appealing activity in B-cell lymphomas are primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma and EBV-associated large B-cell lymphoma. And then the last entity with some recent data is a very difficult-to-treat T-cell lymphoma called extranodal NK T-cell lymphoma nasal type. This is a very aggressive T-cell lymphoma uniformly associated with the Epstein-Barr virus, and a small case series recently published in Blood shows a uniformly high response rate among these very refractory cases. So the checkpoint inhibitors are looking very appealing in Hodgkin lymphoma and select subtypes of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, though I wouldn't say across the board.
Of course, you know, big issue in general with checkpoint inhibitors is predictors of response, which kind of hasn't really played out very well yet. Do you think that EBV testing is something that, from a practical point of view, to consider with some of the non-Hodgkin lymphomas to identify patients who might be treated?
I think right now that is an appealing strategy. I think we still need more information. But what we do know is EBV-transformed diseases, by the nature of the EBV infection, that does increase expression of PD-L1 and thus make it an appealing target. What we've seen in non-EBV-associated cases is there isn't an obvious association between PD-1 expression and response, and I know that's been reflected to some degree in solid tumors as well. So I think it's a potential starting point, but by no means is it the end of the story.
I've asked a number of investigators their hypotheses at a more biologic level about why, for example, Hodgkin lymphoma seems to respond so well. You kind of talked about it, the Reed Sternberg cells and the immune infiltrate around it, but people kind of haven't seemed to get too far beyond that and the chromosomal aberration that you talked about. In your own vision of the pathophysiology of Hodgkin lymphoma, what do you think is going on and why are checkpoint inhibitors so effective?
Well, I think Hodgkin lymphoma is such a unique disease biologically in that only about 1% of the tumor are the cancer cells. And so we've always known since the initial description of this disease that the dominant population are host inflammatory cells, which has long created this conundrum of how these cells are basically hiding in plain sight of immune cells that should be destroying them. And we've had some hints to that. We've known that it's primarily a skewed infiltrate of CD4 cells and an increased presence of T regulatory cells, which are immune suppressive. We know that the Reed-Sternberg itself cell secretes cytokines, which bring immune suppressive T cells to it rather than CD8 effector cells. And now several immune checkpoints have been identified, including, of course, PD-L1 and PD-L2, but also Galectin-1 and others. So it looks like the Hodgkin lymphoma cell, in my mind, is a bit of an evil wizard. It choreographs its own environment in a way to protect it from the host inflammatory response. I think immune checkpoint inhibitors in the form of PD-1 inhibition is potentially one tool to target that. But I think there are multiple immunosuppressive mechanisms at play here. So I don't think it's the only answer, and certainly is not the complete answer, as we know, because a number of patients will, in fact, either not respond or stop responding to the treatment.
So maybe you can continue on in terms of your sort of overview of new agents. You talked about immune therapies, and I'm guessing one of the next things you're going to bring up is CAR T.
I think we have to bring up CAR T cells for sure. I mean, right now, the FDA approved their very first anti-CD19 CAR T cell for pediatric B-cell acute leukemia. And then we anticipate an FDA approval with a different product shortly thereafter in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, followed not too long after by a second product in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And I have to say, as an investigator using these agents, it's been remarkable to see the quality of responses to anti-CD19 CAR T-cell therapy in DLBCL. We know DLBCL is an often curable disease. We cure over two-thirds, probably just about 70% of newly diagnosed DLBCL patients today. But those that we don't cure have a very low rate of cure with second-line therapy, which is typically still high-dose chemotherapy and autologous stem cell transplant. But not everybody's a candidate for that approach due to elderly age, comorbid disease, or failure to respond well to second-line and reinduction chemotherapy. And so very few patients will ultimately be cured with that approach. And those patients who aren't candidates for that therapy or relapse after that therapy really have a dismal prognosis with no standard agents in that space, and the treatment is considered purely palliative. So it's into that exact context that these CAR T cells have been evaluated and the true unmet medical need. Patients who aren't candidates for curative therapy with transplant, who've had more than one prior line of systemic chemotherapy, or who've relapsed after autologous stem cell transplant. And these are patients who have a median overall survival of less than 6 months. And what we've seen in our own practice and really across these clinical trials is that the majority of patients, not just some, but the majority of patients will respond to an anti-CD19 CAR T cell, and that's true now in three different large prospective clinical trials, with fairly reproducibly close to 40% of subjects going into a complete remission. And this is fairly remarkable, and those are rates that are typically at the 3 to 6 month range. So now we're seeing the majority of patients achieve remission and a high proportion of those achieving a complete remission in patients who previously we would never see achieve a complete remission before, let alone having a durable remission. And right now, a number of these remissions that are in place at 3 months persist at 6 months, at 1 year, and later. And the initial phase one studies all have patients out beyond 2 years continuing to be free of disease with previously disease that would have been fairly urgently life-threatening. So I think we're seeing a quality of response here that we haven't seen with any other treatment to date.
So I'd like to maybe explore a little bit where you think both of these immune therapies are ideally utilized right now and maybe in the future. But before we get into it, maybe we can talk a little bit about toxicity tolerability issues. So going back to checkpoint inhibitors, obviously we're all familiar with the autoimmune complications that are seen. Any specific issues that come up in patients with Hodgkin's? And the one that kind of would immediately jump to mind would be pneumonitis, because most of them have gotten bleomycin, some have gotten radiation therapy. How much of a problem has pneumonitis been with these patients and other complications?
Interestingly, and certainly we've seen autoimmune complications in our Hodgkin's patients, it's notable that though we have seen some pneumonitis, it has not been out of proportion with what we've seen in the solid tumor trials. So it doesn't appear to be markedly amplified. You know, I don't think we have a huge volume of data yet to say that it's not increased slightly, but there isn't a dramatically increased signal. And certainly we've been exclusively in Hodgkin's testing this in patients who've had bleomycin exposure previously, and many of whom have had radiation or even other pulmonary toxins like BCNU in the setting of transplant. And pneumonitis isn't seen at a high incidence. We certainly see other things like hypothyroidism occasionally, rashes, colitis, but these have typically been very manageable and have not occurred in the majority of patients.
And, you know, one thing that's interesting about Hodgkin is that you have a fair number of younger patients. Maybe their immune system is more active than older patients where most of the checkpoint agents have been used with solid tumors. Any evidence of any correlation between age and development of autoimmunity problems?
No, I think one could certainly posit that young patients have more robust immunity and have more robust immune responses as a result. But Hodgkin lymphoma, by its very biology, is an immune suppressive disease. And so perhaps that's offsetting some of what we might otherwise see. These are patients who, even before chemotherapy, we know have allergic responses to vaccines and such. So perhaps they're maybe even slightly protected against that. And that's why we don't see an even higher incidence of immune-mediated events. It's interesting that where we have seen a perhaps a signal of that are in patients who've had a prior allogeneic stem cell transplant and then get a PD-1 inhibitor, and their transplanted immune response does appear to be at risk for reactivating and inducing graft-versus-host disease. So those are patients who I would treat very cautiously. It's not an absolute contraindication by any means, but we do think that there's an increased signal of GVHD.
I saw that ibrutinib was just approved for graft versus host disease. And I was curious, is that just an issue with allogeneic transplant? Or what about like solid organ transplants?
You know, it has yet to be explored to my knowledge, but it does appear that what the ibrutinib is probably doing in that context is it does have a suppressive effect on T lymphocytes through a non-BTK-mediated inhibition and probably also helps delete some alloreactive B cells as well. And so there's no necessarily rationale why it would only work in the setting of GVHD because it clearly alloreactive B cells and T-cell immunity are both relevant in solid tumors. So perhaps that's something worth exploring, but I don't have any personal knowledge of it.
I was just kind of curious, were you surprised at that? It just sort of came out of the blue. I'm like, what? And does the effect look important?
I was. I'm not an allogeneic transplanter, so I only recently became aware of the data myself and have to say I was very impressed with it. It's extraordinarily effective. It's well-tolerated. And appears to be successful at being able to wean steroids and exposure to other more toxic agents. So I don't think it's anything we would have predicted based on the pure BTK mechanism, but probably due to both BTK and T-cell activation, there is a dual mechanism whereby it makes sense that wouldn't have immediately occurred to me as the likely target, but it clearly works.
Wow, that's interesting. We want to learn more about it. Anyhow, getting back to immunotherapy. So we chatted a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, with CAR T, there's an issue of cytokine release and also neurotoxicity. I'm curious what's been seen, particularly with the lymphoma patients, diffuse large B-cell. It seems like that is something that docs in practice are going to need to be aware of immediately. What do we know about these complications in general and specifically in these patients?
Yeah, so certainly every CAR T-cell product that's been evaluated in DLBCL has had as their primary adverse events of special interest cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicities. Now, they've been a bit variable across the different compounds that have been evaluated. And so some of that may be due to different co-stimulatory molecules used in the CAR T-cells. So we know that a CD28 co-stimulatory domain produces a more rapid expansion of the CAR T cells, while a 4-1BB co-stimulatory domain has a more gradual onset, and that might mitigate some of the acute onset of cytokine release syndrome. But it's been seen certainly in both settings. It does appear that there is some correlation with disease burden, although that's still being worked out. The higher the disease burden, the higher the risk typically of developing a cytokine release syndrome. It appears in general less than in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and that may be in part related to the disease burden and in part to the distribution of disease as well. disease that's circulating in the blood in high volume may lead to a more rapid expansion and cytokine release compared to more tissue-based tumors where the CAR T cells percolate a bit more. There's a slightly more blunted expansion. And so for that reason, the rate of CRS has been lower in lymphoma than in ALL. It's also been uniformly reversible. And in general, I think what we've seen across these studies is that with increasing comfort level in the setting of clinical trials, identification of cytokine release syndrome, and then using antidotes of sort to offset the cytokine release syndrome, that it can be intervened upon very safely. And what we are now typically doing is using tocilizumab, the IL-6 receptor antibody, which does, in the majority of cases, turn around the fever and hypotension of CRS very rapidly. Dexamethasone is also effective, and I think we have emerging data now from multiple different CAR T-cell trials that have been reported that modest dose dexamethasone does not impair efficacy of the treatment. Obviously, that was an initial fear that you'd ablate these CAR T-cells that were just laboriously created, this precious product, and that would not only decrease the toxicity but efficacy. That hasn't been the case right now. So thus far, tocilizumab at first onset of cytokine release, particularly grade 2 cytokine release, patients who have an isolated fever, which would be grade 1, minimal effect on blood pressure, this can often go away all on its own. Once blood pressure gets affected, we usually then do intervene with tocilizumab, with or without a little bit of dexamethasone for a couple of days. The neurologic side effects similarly appear largely reversible in almost all cases. There are a couple of reports of some lingering mild deficits, but it virtually always does resolve. The neurologic toxicity usually follows the cytokine release syndrome, and patients will usually have had a cresting of their cytokine release syndrome and then have onset of the neurologic side effects. There are various theories to this. Increased time that it takes for the CAR T cells to traffic into the central nervous system, the cytokine release within the cerebrospinal fluid. We know the T cells get in, we know the cytokines get in. We don't think tocilizumab gets in, though dexamethasone does. And so, at least empirically thus far, it does look like dexamethasone does speed recovery of the CAR T cell neurologic toxicities. We're using that earlier now to try and offset that. And these are typically range from mild confusion, word-finding difficulties, somnolence, altered mental status, but it can progress to comatose states or even seizures. But thankfully, these do appear to be, once they're recognized and patients have to have loved ones or family members or friends with them because they might not recognize their altered mental status, who can bring this to the attention of their nurses or their treating physicians, that can be intervened upon and reversed. And thankfully, neither treatment of neurotoxicity or cytokine release syndrome has been associated with loss of efficacy of the CAR T-cell product.
What's the thinking in terms of pathophysiology with the neurologic issues? Is it, again, some type of cytokine release? And what's the time sequence? When do these reactions start to occur?
Yeah, I think it's still being worked out. My own personal theory is that it is a cytokine release phenomenon, but it's within the central nervous system, and that the cytokine-induced inflammation in and around the cerebrum is what's leading to this confusion and misfiring. We know the CAR T cells and the cytokines are there, and so this is purely right now hypothetical, meaning they've been associated. We haven't clearly identified them as an obvious culprit. Some people have given intrathecal chemotherapy by way of ablating the CAR T cells in the central nervous system. I don't think that we've shown that to be absolutely mandatory, since steroids also work effectively. But it does occur a bit later, and the time to onset of these toxicities is a bit variable across the studies. The median onset across the studies of cytokine release syndrome is usually in the 3 to 5 day range, while the onset to the neurologic toxicities is typically in the 5 to 10 day range, so slightly frame shifted.
And what do we know about the relationship, if any, between the development of these syndromes and efficacy?
So interestingly, there has not been a direct correlation between development of the toxicity and response. And so certainly what we've seen is patients can have no neurologic toxicities and no cytokine release and still achieve a complete remission. So it isn't incumbent upon a patient to see an adverse reaction in order to respond to therapy. Certainly, the incidence of these adverse events suggests these CAR T cells are proliferating and releasing their cytokines. But because it is tied to tumor burden, a relatively lower tumor burden might induce a response insufficient to induce a cytokine release clinical syndrome, but sufficient to induce a tumor response. So while I think it does mean that the cells are proliferating, the absence of T cells doesn't mean they're not proliferating.
So I know this anti-CD19 agent being used with diffuse large B-cell that hopefully will be approved is AxiCell. An oncologist wakes up one morning, end of this year, next year, and finds out that this agent is approved. Is this something that they ought to start thinking about as soon as they see somebody relapse after transplant? What about even up front in patients with a very poor prognosis, double hit, for example?
Yeah, I think these are important questions, and it's clearly something that's going to evolve. I think at the time of initial approval, and we'll have to see how specific the label ends up being, but I suspect it'll fairly closely resemble the clinical trial. And that really took patients who are an unmet medical need. These were patients with relapsed or refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who'd relapsed after had at least two prior lines of therapy and had either relapsed after an autologous stem cell transplant or were not a candidate for an autologous stem cell transplant. And in those patients right now who meet those criteria, I would absolutely start thinking about AxiCell. Now, for those patients at their first relapse of DLBCL, who are candidates for second-line therapy, R-ICE, R-DHAP, et cetera, then that would still be recommended for those patients. And only if they failed to respond to that therapy would they meet the eligibility criteria for CAR T-cell therapy. Otherwise, I would say that those patients have to have relapsed after multiple prior lines of therapy, at least two prior lines, or after an autologous stem cell transplant. I think the future raises the question of whether this therapy does move earlier in the course of disease. We've seen that the median number of prior therapies in these studies is high, usually three or four prior lines of therapy, meaning these are pretty beat up patients and oftentimes have had prior stem cell transplant. And so I think right now, while we would target those patients, I think the next question is going to be, what about for these patients who would be candidates for autologous stem cell transplant, but we know that autologous stem cell transplant only cures a minority of these patients who are in their first relapse. So should CAR T-cell therapy replace autologous stem cell transplant at first relapse? And that's a tantalizing idea. My personal prediction, and right now one could only predict, is that the writing is on the wall for autologous stem cell transplant, and that I think that the randomized trials that change the standard of care are taking a patient at first relapse, randomizing them to a CAR T-cell based approach or a traditional salvage chemotherapy and stem cell transplant approach. And my prediction would be that the CAR T-cell approach is going to look better with a higher durable remission rate. And I think that's probably where the future goes. I think in the upfront setting, at least right now, it's going to be hard to make that justification given the overall success rate of standard therapies, including R-CHOP, and even in high-risk subsets, things like dose-adjusted EPOCH-R for double-hit lymphomas. It is encouraging that multiple trials of CAR T-cells in relapsed/refractory DLBCL has seen no difference in response rates in double-hit and triple-hit lymphomas for CAR T-cell therapy. So historically, patients who relapse with a double- or triple-hit lymphoma have a very poor prognosis, have very low rate of being successfully salvaged with additional lines of chemotherapy or targeted agents such as they exist. That isn't true for CAR T-cells, which work just as well for relapsed double- and triple-hit lymphoma as they do for any other chemotherapy relapsed DLBCL. Whether that's a population where we should be targeting up front is a good question for a clinical trial, but not answered yet. I think what we don't know is that if you give a patient with a high-risk disease like a double-hit lymphoma, R-CHOP or dose-adjusted EPOCH-R, and then once they achieve remission, maybe consolidate them with, say, a CAR T-cell product in their first remission, the same way we might consider using a stem cell transplant. But we really don't know if that's going to be effective. And in fact, it might be that in a minimal residual disease state, there isn't sufficient tumor antigen to actually activate and proliferate those CAR T cells. So these are all studies that need to be done. But right now, chemotherapy refractory or post-transplant DLBCL, and looking into the not too distant future, clinical trials looking at moving it earlier in first relapse for these patients.
So I'm going to force myself to go off of CAR T, although I'll tell you, I recently interviewed Fred Locke, the principal investigator of the Zuma trial, for 2.5 hours just about CAR T.
Good. There's lots to talk about.
So, okay, we got a little taste there. Let's go back to checkpoint inhibitors, though, with Hodgkin lymphoma. Same question. We talked before about efficacy, biology, and tolerability. Can you talk about where right now you think the drugs are most appropriately used and where you think we might be in a couple years?
Sure. I mean, I think right now, clearly in the relapse refractory space, these are highly active agents. I would say that we see excellent response rates and encouraging durability in patients who relapsed after autologous stem cell transplant, as well as patients who aren't candidates for autologous stem cell transplant. We've also seen encouraging efficacy in patients who've had prior brentuximab vedotin or who have not. So currently, I would say that for those patients who have their first relapse of classical Hodgkin lymphoma, that's still the most proven curative modality we have is second-line treatment and high-dose chemotherapy with autologous stem cell transplant. And so for the majority of Hodgkin lymphoma patients who are transplant candidates at relapse, I would consider that the appropriate current standard of care. For those patients who relapse after an autologous stem cell transplant, I think we have two options now in that space, either checkpoint inhibitors or brentuximab vedotin. Both look similarly effective, and I would think about risk-benefit ratios, toxicity profiles, and comorbidities in making that selection. For those patients who get reinduction therapy at relapse but don't achieve a remission, those patients have a low chance of cure with autologous stem cell transplant. And at that point, I would think about an alternate therapy prior to transplant with either brentuximab vedotin or one of the two approved immune checkpoint inhibitors. Right now, I wouldn't say we have sufficient data to recommend one immune checkpoint inhibitor over another, or frankly, an immune checkpoint inhibitor over brentuximab vedotin. I think they're all highly effective in this space, but with clearly different toxicity profiles.
I was going to ask you about B-vedotin because I think people would jump right to checkpoint inhibitors hoping for a prolonged response, maybe even unmaintained response. But you do see that with B-vedotin. I think a lot of docs are not aware of that. When you try to indirectly compare the chance of launching a patient into a prolonged remission between a checkpoint inhibitor, B-vedotin, what's your general sense right now?
My impression is both can do it. The fact is both drugs have a similarly high overall response rate. Both drugs induce complete remissions only in a small proportion. The complete remission rate is probably higher with brentuximab vedotin, and about half of the patients who achieve a complete remission will be sustained more than 2 years later. So I would say for a patient who gets brentuximab vedotin and achieves a complete remission, they have a reasonably good chance of having a sustained remission well after they've completed their, say, 1 year course of therapy. For a patient who does not achieve a complete remission with brentuximab vedotin, their chance of progression is very high. The partial remission patients typically progress relatively quickly. And so if I were to predict somebody on brentuximab who may be durable in their remissions, it would be the complete remitting patients to initial therapy. Interestingly, the same exact paradigm isn't true with the checkpoint inhibitors. Though the vast majority of those are partial, not complete responses, we do see some of those responses evolve to CRs over time, and even some of these partial responses can be durable. So I would look at the toxicity profile. Certainly, they're very different. With brentuximab vedotin, the big thing is typically peripheral neuropathy and the need to dose reduce or stop dosing if peripheral neuropathy is getting significant. With immune checkpoint inhibitors, we're really thinking about more of immune-mediated toxicity events, again, usually which are reversible.
So maybe we can get into some of your cases and get into these and other points. Why don't we start out talking about your 46-year-old lady?
Sure. So this is a patient who I treated, a 46-year-old woman who presented with advanced stage classical Hodgkin lymphoma. She had B symptoms at presentation, nodal disease above and below the diaphragm. Standard therapy, virtually any patient who's sufficiently fit and well with adequate organ function is with ABVD, which cures the majority of both limited and advanced stage patients, and that's what this patient received. She did achieve initial remission, but unfortunately progressed relatively shortly thereafter and underwent second-line therapy with ICE. She again achieved a response to ICE and underwent autologous stem cell transplant.
Could I just interrupt you there and ask about the issue of induction prior to transplant or bridge to transplant, which has always been as what this patient got, which was ICE. But bevacizumab has been looked at. It seems like it didn't really get very much uptake. What about checkpoint inhibitors in this space and also the combination of bevacizumab and checkpoint inhibitors in this space?
And that investigation is ongoing, and I think that's a potentially great idea. It's true that brentuximab alone was evaluated, and only a minority of patients achieved a sufficient response to move right to transplant. The majority of those patients did need additional intensive chemotherapy to get there. So starting with the chemotherapy up front means you're going to generally move the majority of patients to transplant quicker. You know, whether brentuximab plus something else, either brentuximab plus salvage chemotherapy or brentuximab plus a checkpoint inhibitor, which might be the best case scenario, is a matter of clinical investigation and may very well ultimately replace it. But right now, I would say standard reinduction chemotherapy remains the treatment of choice.
I was going to ask you about the combination of bevacizumab and a checkpoint inhibitor, because I know it has been piloted, I think, even up front in older patients.
Correct.
When you think about that combination, in your mind, is it sort of additive or synergistic?
I don't know yet. I think it's too early to say. I think there's a really thoughtful rationale in the combination. One is a very targeted cytotoxic in the brentuximab vedotin. The other is targeted in the microenvironment. By a targeted cytotoxicity, you may release more antigen and thus improve activation in the setting of an immune checkpoint inhibitor. I think it's a great combination. I think they act through completely different and potentially synergistic mechanisms, but purely hypothesis at this point.
So another issue, looking back at this case retrospectively, and before we get on to what happened with this lady, is the issue of once she had the transplant, I don't know exactly when it occurred related to the Athira trial data, but is this someone, I'm curious how you approach the issue of post-transplant consolidation with bevacizumab and whether she was considered for that or would be considered for that today?
That's a great question. So brentuximab vedotin was studied in the Athira trial as a consolidation therapy after autologous stem cell transplant. That data was released after I treated my patient, so there wasn't data to guide that at that time. I will say that had she been relapsing at a time when that data had been released as a positive study, then I would have treated her with brentuximab vedotin consolidation. That study specifically looked at high-risk patients, which is very important. Those patients relapsing in less than a year of their transplant or primary refractory disease. These are patients who, among relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma patients, have the lowest cure rate with standard therapy. So she's somebody where I would have. Now, a typical lower-risk relapsing patient, I wouldn't extrapolate the data beyond the high-risk population because that's who's been studied. It is important to note that the Athera trial had a progression-free but not an overall survival benefit, which almost certainly reflects the fact that there was crossover in the standard arm, and so those patients got brentuximab at the time of their relapse. But I think there's no question in a high-risk patient, it would be ideal to prevent recurrence in the first place. So if this patient were being treated by me today in relapsing quickly after ABVD, I would do salvage chemotherapy, autologous transplant, and then brentuximab vedotin consolidation.
And, you know, from what I've seen from those data and how people reacted to it, the two major high-risk features that globally seem to kick people into doing this is one, early relapse, which this lady had because it was 6 months, but also, I guess, extranodal disease. Did she have that?
This patient didn't have extranodal disease, but certainly those two, primary refractory, early relapse, and extranodal disease are the big factors.
What about disease burden? Do you consider that?
Typically don't. These are patients where the biology really drives response. And so somebody who's had a 2-year remission, even if they relapse with bulky disease, those patients have a very good success rate with cytoreductive therapy.
So this lady unfortunately did relapse or have progressive disease after transplant. I see she got a couple rounds of chemotherapy and then bevacizumab.
Yeah, and it was interesting. She was being treated at a time not only had the Athera trial not been released, but brentuximab vedotin hadn't even been FDA approved. And so at that time, her third line treatment of choice was a gemcitabine-based chemotherapy regimen. But as would be predicted in somebody with chemotherapy-resistant disease, that didn't work very well. And as that was failing, the patient, lo and behold, brentuximab gets FDA approved. We started her on that agent, and she responded beautifully. She achieved a remission. That remission lasted for a good period of time. The labeled dose of this treatment is for up to a year. And what we found with this patient does happen a fair amount of the time is she did develop peripheral sensory neuropathy. Remember, she'd been exposed to previously vinca alkaloids and other neurotoxins, so we dose reduced and ultimately had to discontinue her treatment short of the full year. She then enjoyed a remission for a period longer, but ultimately did relapse.
It's interesting, though, she did get a CR out of the bevacizumab, but then she had disease progression. When you see a patient who gets a CR out of bevacizumab, generally, what are you expecting?
The fact is, half of those people will stay in remission. So I look at each patient on a case-by-case basis, but the real question for me in somebody who's relapsing, who achieves a remission to brentuximab, is am I going to take that patient to an allogeneic stem cell transplant with curative intent? Now, if nearly half of these people will be sustained, then we might not need to take these patients to allotransplant. I always look for a donor, and if they are young and have a donor, then I typically will take those patients in their first CR to brentuximab to transplant. Patients who are older, certainly patients who don't have a high-quality matched donor, I'll keep on the brentuximab. This patient, we did look for a donor. She didn't have an allogeneic donor available within either her family or in the registry, and so we elected brentuximab alone. I don't think that's an answered question right now. I think it's an area of controversy, and I think about it that the youngest patients with a good donor, I still err on the side of transplant, but I think that's a moving target today.
So, unfortunately, she did develop disease progression 2 years later. Incidentally, what happened to the peripheral neuropathy? Did it resolve?
The peripheral neuropathy improved significantly. It persists to this day as grade 1 peripheral neuropathy, but is not resolved entirely.
So then she goes on a PD-1 agent.
She did, and at that time it was a protocol-based PD-1 inhibitor. She was on one of the earlier trials. She rapidly achieved a remission in all sites of disease. She tolerated the treatment well. She did initially develop some hyperthyroidism that then evolved into hypothyroidism and now requires thyroid hormone replacement, but otherwise has had no immunologic events and has done very well on PD-1 inhibition, which she continues on at this time.
Which agent did she get?
She's getting nivolumab.
And did she have a CR?
She's not in a CR. Interestingly, her nodes have shrank down considerably. They're actually largely normal in size, but there is some FDG avidity within them that is completely stable in size. And one of the things that with these agents is that PRs can be durable, and some of that may be reflecting the fact that we're seeing an ongoing immune inflammatory response as opposed to active disease in those sites.
And how long has it been now that she's been on treatment?
It's been over a year at this point, and she is in ongoing remission.
So it's interesting you mentioned about the hyperthyroidism presenting. I'm not sure I've heard that before. How did she present it, clinically or laboratory?
Clinically. So she presented with some tachycardia and jitteriness, and we checked her thyroid studies and found it. And I think it probably reflects the initial immune attack and thus a sudden release of the thyroid hormone, something akin to what we can see in an inflammatory thyroiditis where patients initially get thyrotoxic and then wane. I think the hypothyroidism is more commonly reported. Both are certainly reported. I wonder if one looks back carefully, if the patients who develop hypothyroidism have a subclinical hyperthyroidism that precedes it due to the initial immune attack.
That's interesting. I assume you don't see exophthalmus.
We did not, no.
Interesting.
It probably would need to be more long-lasting for that.
So I wonder if, and again, this question comes up in every tumor type where checkpoint inhibitors are being used, which is the question of, is there a point where you stop therapy? I don't know what her protocol calls for, but what about the issue of stopping therapy? Have you stopped it just preemptively? Have you seen patients who had to stop because of toxicity and then had a continued response? What about unmaintained response?
Yeah, I've seen several different scenarios that can play out. I think the clinical trials have been different. Initial clinical trials would take patients who were in a sustained CR after a year and the agent could stop. And some of those patients remained in remission and others relapsed. And the patients who relapsed would usually respond to PD-1 inhibition when it was resumed. What I've typically been doing is continuing the agent in the absence of toxicity. Patients who are clearly having significant immune-mediated toxicity and are in a complete remission, I'm comfortable stopping the drug for mild toxicity. Certainly, we're dose-reducing or stopping the drug for severe toxicity in either context. But right now, I think all of these things are possible. Some patients will have a durable remission if you stop the drug. I think the data is going to bear out that the majority of people, when you stop it, certainly less than a year after achieving their initial remission, are likely to subsequently progress. But what is the perfect duration to be on these checkpoint inhibitors? We still don't know, whether it's a year, 2 years, or more.
Have you seen any delayed autoimmune toxicity? I've heard about arthralgias or arthritises that may pop up, dermatologic problems. Have you seen anything late?
I have. It's interesting that these reactions, unlike most drug reactions, if you're out 6 to 8 weeks, you think you're the patient tolerating it. We can see this out a year, 2 years later, immune-mediated toxicities develop. And one wonders if there are other factors that might contribute some immune activation, including an infection that might precipitate such a reaction. So I've certainly seen this rashes, pneumonitis, even some inflammatory colitis that have occurred later. I think these fall into the range of being idiosyncratic.
So let's talk a little bit about CLL, a lot going on there also. In your paper, you talked about all the new B-cell receptor signaling inhibitors that we'll get into, but maybe we can start out talking about your 76-year-old lady.
Sure. So 76-year-old woman who was initially diagnosed, as most patients are these days, with an incidental finding on a complete blood count, a lymphocytosis that's further worked up, flow cytometry, with some cytogenetics, confirm a diagnosis of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. This patient was initially evaluated with fluorescence in situ hybridization and found to have an isolated 13q deletion. This is the most common cytogenetic finding in CLL, and thankfully the one associated with the most indolent biology and the most favorable natural history. And oftentimes these patients can simply be observed in the absence of clinical indications. And sure enough, she was. And we observed her for multiple years, over 5 years. She could be observed with gradually progressing lymphocytosis, no significant cytopenias. She then developed more abrupt onset development of progressive lymphocytosis, lymphadenopathy, developed some fatigue, and blood counts showed that she was now developing some anemia and thrombocytopenia. This change in clinical behavior prompts question of whether there's been some evolution in the disease. And sure enough, we recenter fluorescence in situ hybridization, and she'd acquired a 17p deletion secondarily. So she now had a 13q and a 17p deletion, which predicts her more aggressive natural history.
Incidentally, in terms of this issue of evolution, clonal evolution, is it your approach to refish anybody who you're going to change therapy on with CLL?
I do recommend that. Nowadays, we know that there are differential responses to treatments based on the cytogenetic profile, and we know that the disease can evolve over time. So I certainly would. And certainly, if the progression is nodal as opposed to in the peripheral blood, always important to do a biopsy of rapid nodal progression, because that could denote a Richter's transformation to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which would be treated quite differently.
Globally, what percent of patients roughly present with 17p, and what percent of patients acquire it?
It's a small minority that present with it at baseline, less than 10%. But among patients who have relapsed or refractory disease, that incidence is much higher. Close to a quarter or more of patients in the relapsed refractory setting will have a 17p deletion.
And from the point of view of responses to treatment, does it make a difference whether it's presenting primarily or later on in the disease in terms of, for example, lack of response to chemo and response to biologics such as ibrutinib or venetoclax?
It does. So a 17p deletion, either at diagnosis or relapse, predicts chemotherapy resistance. Now, oftentimes, these patients will achieve a response to something like FCR chemotherapy, but it is typically a partial response and a short-lived response. And so based on that, in the initial setting, we do now recommend ibrutinib as initial treatment for patients with 17p deleted CLL, even if they are young and fit, because even the young and fit patient is unlikely to have a durable remission from FCR.
So before you get into what happened with this patient, I'm kind of curious if when she first presented, again, without the 17p, she had had an indication to treat. How do you generally approach those patients? And there's a lot of controversy in terms of something like FCR versus ibrutinib.
There is. You know, from my perspective, my first question is this patient a young patient? The median age of this disease is 72 or so, and so most of these patients are older. But there are patients in their late 40s, 50s, even early 60s, who are extremely fit and have decades of life expectancy ahead of them. We know that the response rate in the absence of a 17p deletion is quite high to FCR, and that many of those responses can be durable, particularly in patients with mutated IGHV. A young patient with a mutated IGHV, they might have complete disease eradication and never need treatment after 6 months of FCR. So I do sequencing up front, and for patients without a 17p deletion, and particularly if they're a mutated IGHV, if they're a young patient, I'll recommend FCR.
What about the older patient where you're maybe not going to use FCR, but if, again, you compare chemotherapy, anti-CD20, BR, obinutuzumab, chlorambucil, do you still have that same hope or intention to try to go for an unmaintained remission, but just not with FCR, or do you lean more towards ibrutinib?
I think about each case and decide. The fact is for patients 65 and older, I won't give FCR. And we have data from the German CLL study group that in the elderly patients, FCR and BR have similar efficacy, but more toxicity with FCR. So in an older adult, I'll think about bendamustine rituximab. In those patients, I'll think about ibrutinib. I'll think about obinutuzumab chlorambucil. The latter agent, obinutuzumab chlorambucil, is based on a clinical trial, a very good clinical trial, specifically in older, unfit patients, patients with multiple medical comorbidities by definition were enrolled in that trial. So they weren't sufficiently fit for chemotherapy. I have to say today, most of those patients have been subsumed by ibrutinib, meaning if they're not a good candidate for chemotherapy, then they're probably a better candidate for ibrutinib than obinutuzumab chlorambucil. There are patients I'll still consider for that latter therapy if they have multiple comorbidities and maybe they're at high risk of toxicity on ibrutinib, such as they're on therapeutic anticoagulation with warfarin and thus at high risk of bleeding. I would certainly think about obinutuzumab and chlorambucil in that patient. But what about the older patient with no medical comorbidities? And here I'm really deciding between bendamustine rituximab and ibrutinib. And the very elderly patient, I certainly use ibrutinib. For the 66-year-old who's very healthy and fit, I talk about these two different approaches. I say one approach means 4 to 6 months of chemotherapy and then no ongoing treatment, while the other is a pill, generally well-tolerated, but about a quarter of patients will have to stop the drug due to toxicity. And I talk about patients whether they want a sustained oral therapy or would they rather a short course of chemotherapy? And oftentimes, the elderly but not very elderly patients will often prefer to have a short course of chemotherapy as opposed to ibrutinib. More often than not, for my 65-year-old patients or older, I'll use ibrutinib, but there are still some patients where I think chemotherapy makes sense.
You know, it's interesting that you put out that figure of 25%, and you know, I've heard different estimates, but I kind of have the feeling that whatever that number is, it's a lot higher than people think it is. And that ibrutinib is more of a challenge than people think it is. And I think she seems like she's a pretty good example because it looks like you, of course, started on ibrutinib, 17P, first-line therapy, but she had some problems.
This is an older patient. I thought she'd be a great candidate for ibrutinib. But as can happen, you know, there are a number of notable toxicities. She did have some bleeding and bruising. Her bleeding were nosebleeds. They weren't life-threatening bleeds. These weren't intracranial hemorrhages or GI bleeding, but certainly troublesome. But I have to say, her primary complaint to me wasn't the nosebleeds. She didn't, you know, care that much about them because they always stopped. Her complaint were the joint aches and pains. And a lot of these patients can, for whatever reason, develop significant arthralgias, which really do impair quality of life. I think this is going to be a lesser issue with the newer generation drugs like acalabrutinib. But for patients who are intolerant of that, thankfully, we now have another drug. And so that's why when she said, look, this is really treatment that I can't continue, I'd like to stop it, we changed her to venetoclax, and she's continued to respond beautifully and tolerate it very well.
I'm curious, when you started the venetoclax, what her situation was in terms of, you know, the white count and nodes, et cetera, and how you sort of classified her in terms of risk for tumor lysis.
This is critical with venetoclax to assess their tumor lysis risk prior to initiation of therapy. There's very nice algorithms, and it's part of the drug label. By this time, when this patient started ibrutinib, she had the expected lymphocyte surge. With initial treatment, she declined over the subsequent couple of months. And by the time that we changed her to venetoclax, she had detectable disease, but within the low-risk range. The adenopathy was gone. She had a mild circulating lymphocytosis. And so we treated her as an outpatient with monitoring. She took some allopurinol. She had no clinical or laboratory tumor lysis syndrome.
I'm curious if you have any experience with high-risk patients, you know, patients you've had to put in the hospital, for example, to monitor for tumor lysis.
Absolutely. The high risk of tumor lysis was identified early on in these clinical trials when patients were started on the target dose of the drug. This lesson was learned that this can induce a rapid lysis within hours of drug exposure. And so these studies went back and redesigned the intrapatient dose escalation. So the patient started a low dose, 20 milligrams for a week, 50 milligrams for another week, 100, 200, and 400. In so doing, clinical tumor lysis syndrome is very uncommon. Patients with high tumor burden might have some laboratory tumor lysis syndrome, non-organ threatening. And so my experience in following the label, put patients on allopurinol, give them some hydration, admit them to the hospital, and start them at 20 milligrams, is that we do not see clinically relevant tumor lysis syndrome. And I credit that more to the slow dose escalation than to the supportive care. I think ultimately, we're probably going to find that we're admitting too many of these patients to the hospital and that we might be able to be a little less cautious in some of these intermediate risk patients who are escalating slowly. But I think right now we err on the side of caution, and I would recommend that everybody follow the label, but be comforted that by doing the weekly dose escalation starting at the low dose, that clinically significant TLS is very uncommon.
When you do put people in the hospital, how long are they there?
We keep them there for usually just a couple of days. One night if they come in the morning, maybe two nights if they come in later in the day. The fact is, when lysis happens, it's quick. So as long as people have had a solid 24 or so hours, I feel quite comfortable sending the patient home.
And this patient at this point receiving the venetoclax has no symptomatology, no side effects?
This patient is now in a complete remission, tolerating the drug without any toxicities whatsoever.
Of course, venetoclax, we know, like ibrutinib, has activity beyond 17p disease. Of course, it's being looked at by itself as well as in combination, I think, with ibrutinib. Where do you think things are going to land with these two drugs over the next couple of years in terms of sequencing or combinations?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now we have some data on sequencing. There was some data presented at an ASH meeting in 2015 that looked at patients who were either intolerant or relapsed after either ibrutinib or idelalisib and looked at their responses to venetoclax as their next line of therapy, and the majority of patients did respond. For patients like this who were progressing or intolerant to ibrutinib, their response rate was just over 60% for receiving venetoclax. I think ultimately, the question's really going to be in combination therapy. We know that venetoclax combines well with rituximab. There's some data with obinutuzumab. I think it's very appealing going forward to think about combining multi-targeted inhibition with an anti-CD20, the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax, a BTK inhibitor such as ibrutinib, or a PI3K inhibitor. And we have some initial early data with triple combinations with a kinase inhibitor, an anti-apoptotic agent, venetoclax, and a CD20. And the initial data, though just phase one and ongoing studies, so nothing mature, shows very high rates of minimal residual disease eradication. So my personal prediction is that it'll be a multi-targeted approach moving forward in a triple combination, combining venetoclax with a kinase inhibitor, and that ultimately that will hopefully be fixed duration therapy as opposed to sustained treatment. And I think the better we eradicate the disease, the likelier that goal is.
Yeah, and of course, there are financial toxicities. As we talked about, there are physical toxicities. It would be awesome if it could just be a short round of treatment. And speaking of toxicities, you mentioned acalabrutinib, and I'm curious what we know about other BTK inhibitors like this agent about efficacy, but also in terms of tolerability, because as you mentioned, ibrutinib is not necessarily always a walk in the park.
Acalabrutinib, based on the initial data and the initial study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, looks very effective in CLL and less toxic. So what we're not seeing as much of are the arthralgias, the atrial fibrillation, and the bleeding. And this probably reflects less activity in off-target kinases, ITK, and TEC. And so I think the more exquisitely targeted agents, these next generations may have an improved tolerability profile.
What about efficacy?
Efficacy looks excellent. Without comparing head-to-head, I wouldn't say one is better than the other, but I would say they look quite comparable.
When you talk about a 25% discontinuation rate, I think I've seen data even as high as 50%. You would think in a head-to-head trial, maybe that's high enough that theoretically, if you just lowered that, it might be enough to start using it.
I think you're absolutely right. You can only garner benefit of a drug if you can tolerate it. The majority of patients do tolerate the ibrutinib, but I would say a significant minority will not over time, and it's great to have alternate agents available. And ultimately, maybe a next-generation agent is going to be better earlier in the course of disease.
So as long as we're on alternate agents, I was going to ask you later when we talk about follicular lymphoma about PI3 kinase inhibitors, but you mentioned it already. And I saw that you've done work looking at toxicity with adalimumab. Can you talk about right now what we know about adalimumab in CLL as well as FL, but particularly the tolerability and toxicity issues, the autoimmune problems, and again, other agents, the one I've heard about is copanlisib, whether they look more promising from that point of view?
Yeah, the PI3K inhibitors, particularly idelalisib, is highly effective in relapse refractory CLL and highly effective in quite refractory follicular lymphoma. Now, there has been some attention paid, as appropriately with any new drug, to the toxicity profile. And the toxicity profile has been related to immune-mediated or autoimmune complications, including a colitis, a pneumonitis, and a chemical or immune-mediated hepatitis with idelalisib, as well as some increased risk of infections. And the increased infectious risks, and including an increased death from infections, actually prompted early closure of some frontline clinical trials with idelalisib. I think, though, that an important message is this is a highly active drug. Now, in relapse refractory CLL, we do have alternate drugs that target the high-risk populations, like venetoclax and ibrutinib. Both effectively target high-risk population 17P, complex karyotype, etc. Idelalisib also works well in that context and is an available option, though I would typically favor one of the other agents given the toxicity profiles. For a follicular lymphoma patient, idelalisib was specifically studied in a true unmet medical need, patients who are refractory to both anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody and alkylating based chemotherapy. These are folks with no standard available options that are proven in that context, and these are patients who are at high risk of dying of follicular lymphoma. In that context, the response rate was close to 55%, the progression-free survival was close to a year. These are certainly respectable findings in a high-risk population. So I think you have to assess what the rest of the landscape is. Only a minority of patients develop an immune-mediated toxicity on idelalisib. So what I would say is, as long as you understand the toxicity profile and monitor patients appropriately, most patients can tolerate this very safely. Things like the hepatitis, which we see as a transaminitis, typically occurs early in the course, median of 6 to 8 weeks after starting. So I do recommend monitoring patients' LFTs for the first couple of months of starting their treatment. The colitis is typically a later event, 6 months or so after starting patients developing diarrhea. So they have to know to call with that. Patients need to know to call with cough, shortness of breath, fever to look for pneumonitis. And in those settings, typically steroids help quell that down. And many patients can be resumed on idelalisib at a dose reduction. So right now, I don't often use it in CLL due to other available options. I do use it in refractory follicular lymphoma, where it's been studied and certainly is effective.
Again, what about other PI3 kinase inhibitors, including copanlisib?
Yeah, there's some intriguing but early data with copanlisib. There's also a drug TGR-1202, which is another PI3K delta inhibitor, which at least preliminarily looks to be similarly highly effective, but with fewer of these immune-mediated toxicities like hepatitis and colitis. So I think we're still seeing data emerge, but I think what idelalisib teaches us is it's an effective class of drugs in unmet medical needs, but I suspect next-generation compounds like we're talking about may ultimately offer an improved risk-to-benefit ratio.
So we sort of segued there into follicular lymphoma. Maybe we can finish out hearing about your 67-year-old lady who had follicular lymphoma.
Yeah, so I had a 67-year-old patient with follicular lymphoma presented with non-bulky, non-painful lymphadenopathy. Imaging showed disease above and below the diaphragm, stage 3A disease, but without any organ-threatening disease or particularly symptomatic, and so as with other indolent B-cell lymphomas we observed. She observed for about 2 years, by which time her adenopathy had progressed. After a bit of a waxing and waning course, it had steadily progressed and was now causing symptoms, some discomfort, and the neck nodes were a bit unsightly.
Just out of curiosity, before you go on, when you think back to her initial presentation, another option to observing her might have been, or was, rituximab alone. How do you decide between observation and R alone?
Well, I typically, if somebody truly has no indication for a therapy, my inclination is to observe. A number of patients can be observed for years before requiring therapy. I do use rituximab monotherapy, and those typically are, for me, patients who have non-bulky disease but do warrant treatment. So, for example, somebody can have bilateral cervical lymph node disease that's 2, 2.5 centimeters, relatively small nodes. But because they're superficial, they're clearly visible. The patient nicks themselves when they're shaving. Giving bendamustine or other cytotoxic chemotherapy in that setting for low disease burden to me is a bit overkill. And so for low disease burden patients who warrant treatment due to cosmetics or early symptoms, that's who I favor rituximab monotherapy for.
So this lady eventually did require treatment. I see she got BR times 6, went into a complete remission. Then what?
Well, this patient achieved a remission to bendamustine rituximab, tolerated very well, achieved 6 complete cycles. Just short of 2 years, about 1.5 years after achieving remission, she again progressed.
Just before you get into that, I see that she did not get maintenance therapy. Do you generally use maintenance after chemo R? And what about this situation?
I consider maintenance therapy optional. With this patient, we talked about it. We explained that the study of maintenance rituximab versus observation alone does show a progression-free survival benefit in the range of about 15%, but no difference whatsoever in overall survival or rate of transformation. And so the question emerged, you can have a slightly longer remission with rituximab maintenance, or the same treatment is likely to work just as well at the time of progression. And this particular patient thought about it and said, I'd rather be off treatment. And so we did not. But I talk about it with patients with high disease burdens. Patients with low disease burdens weren't included in that trial, which was the PRIMA trial. So I always think about it in patients with high disease burden. But in the absence of a survival benefit, I do shared decision-making with the patient.
So she had then disease progression after the BR, a year and a half later. I'm just kind of curious, when you saw her at that point, kind of what were you thinking in terms of her prognosis and treatment options?
Well, one thing, I was concerned that her prognosis was relatively poor for a follicular lymphoma patient. And one thing that we've seen emerge in multiple data sets now is that patients who progress within 2 years of their initial treatment have a high chance of dying related to their follicular lymphoma, while those patients who have a remission of 2 years or longer have a life expectancy in general on par with age match controls in the general population. So I was concerned that she was in a small group, approximately 20% of follicular lymphoma patients fit into this group and have an inferior prognosis. So options in that setting include things like R-CHOP chemotherapy. It would include higher dose therapy and stem cell transplant, and it would include certain novel agents. But notably, very little data exists specifically in that patient population. There's one clinical trial that's been preliminarily reported called the MAGNIFY trial. And this trial looked at lenalidomide rituximab specifically in a subgroup of patients who relapsed within 2 years of their initial treatment in second line. And what this study showed is about 50% of patients responded. Most of those were partial remissions. And so lenalidomide rituximab is a non-chemotherapy-based option, which now has proven efficacy in that population.
And I see that she actually got the so-called R-square regimen.
Correct.
What happened?
So she got lenalidomide rituximab. She's achieved a partial remission and continues in partial remission and is doing well on that regimen.
As you looked at her individually, why is it that you went ahead with R-squared as opposed to, for example, transplant?
Well, this patient, by the time we were treating her, was in her 70s. The role of transplant is not established in these high-risk early progressors. In a young patient, in the absence of that data, I would think about more intensive therapy and transplant. But for somebody in their 70s, transplant carries a much higher rate of toxicity. And so if we have other available tools, I would favor that. So that includes things like lenalidomide rituximab. And if she was multiply refractory, that's an example where idelalisib would be a reasonable option as well.
And of course, the R-squared regimen is actually being looked at up front in a clinical trial. I don't think the results are out yet. What's been your experience in general utilizing this regimen in follicular lymphoma, and how do you utilize it? In what situations? Are there any situations patient doesn't want chemo where you'd even give it up front?
I typically wouldn't right now, although certainly there's no doubt that it is an effective agent in the frontline setting. The data that we have available to us at present are from two phase two clinical trials, one from the MD Anderson, the other from the Alliance or CLGB cooperative group. Both showed very high overall and very high complete remission rates for len and rituximab. So I think it's a very exciting regimen. It was sufficiently exciting to mount a 1,000-person phase three randomized trial called the Relevance Trial. I do think that trial has the potential to completely alter the standard of care and make lenalidomide rituximab a frontline option. Otherwise, my general approach is to reserve it as an option in the relapse setting. We have now data both from the Alliance, CLGB, as well as the MAGNIFY study and others, showing efficacy across the board in relapse follicular lymphoma, meaning including the early progressors, as well as the later progressors can respond beautifully to the lenalidomide rituximab regimen. So I will often use it as my first option at relapse, as opposed to going to a second-line chemotherapy where we previously might use, say, R-CHOP. I'll often use lenalidomide rituximab instead now.
Speaking of ASH and changing standard of care, of course, I've got to ask you about the big obinutuzumab paper that was presented as a plenary. Maybe you can comment on what was seen there, what you think it means, and maybe are we someday going to be looking at obinutuzumab lenalidomide?
And we already are looking at that, certainly. This particular study was called the Gallium study, and it compared rituximab-based chemotherapy to obinutuzumab-based chemotherapy, the two different anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies. The chemotherapy was up to the centers to choose, and so options included either CHOP, CVP, or bendamustine in combination with those antibodies. Each investigator didn't select for the patient. The institution decided what their standard regimen was going to be. So some institutions gave R-CHOP, other institutions gave obinutuzumab CHOP, some obinutuzumab bendamustine as their standard, etc. Rituximab CHOP or rituximab bendamustine as their standard. So what that study then did is looked at obinutuzumab chemo versus rituximab chemo for 6 months, and then followed that with maintenance therapy for 18 months with the respective antibody included in induction. So all patients received induction followed by maintenance. Now, there was no difference whatsoever in terms of overall or complete response rates. However, during the maintenance phase, there was a separation in terms of progression-free survival favoring the obinutuzumab-treated patients. And the absolute benefit was on the order of 7.5%. There was a significant hazard ratio in reduction of progression or death, and so it was a positive trial. There was also increased toxicity in the obinutuzumab arm, increased infusion reactions, increased cytopenias. And so that needs to be balanced against the benefit in the setting of there being no overall survival benefit in that trial. My typical approach is to consider obinutuzumab-based therapy. You know, the fact is some patients get maintenance and some patients don't get maintenance. There was no difference in induction therapy. I think whether you choose obinutuzumab, bendamustine, R-CHOP, or R-bendamustine, whether you choose obinutuzumab or rituximab-based therapy as induction, I think is entirely appropriate therapy. For my patients who I'm going to give maintenance for, the obinutuzumab-treated patients in maintenance had a longer progression-free survival. So I typically will use obinutuzumab maintenance in patients who I'm giving maintenance therapy for in follicular lymphoma.
So does that mean you would use obinutuzumab maintenance after rituximab induction?
I would consider it. The fact is, we don't always decide at diagnosis if patients are going to be good candidates for maintenance or not. And there is more toxicity associated with the obinutuzumab. And the benefit emerged during maintenance. So this is, I think, a creative approach. I think it's perfectly fine to give obinutuzumab-based therapy with induction followed by maintenance or not. For me, I will give either rituximab or obinutuzumab-based therapy, but if I am going to proceed with maintenance, I'll typically use obinutuzumab maintenance.